Hello and welcome to Culture with me, Robert Bound, where today we're looking at how we put together our March issue number 101. And it's not just any old issue. This is the bad boy that celebrates our 10th birthday and sees the first major redesign in the magazine's history. It's had a refresh, there's more white space on the page, a different way of doing photography as we heard a month ago, and maybe our stories sing a little sweeter on the page. We hope you like it. So we'll delve into the Culture section in four ways, by talking about the future of the game show, the orchestra for hire much beloved by pop stars requiring a string section. We'll get into the shoes of Paul Auster's editor in London, and we'll investigate an unlikely new branch of print success, the chilling world of real crime in Germany. That's what this show based on that magazine looks like. It's Culture with me, Robert Bound. All right, first to Oslo. We sent Susie Mazur to Norway to investigate and have a go at a new TV game show that aims to bridge the gap between Saturday night entertainment and the vast new market in playing games on your smartphone. So they play in a studio in Oslo and you play on your phone at home. But what? It's a time-travelling thing in which contestants are transported to the Jurassic era or the Wild West and have to fight or outthink their opponents to win the star prize. Susie Mazur, fresh from Lost in Time's studio in Oslo, is here to tell us what it's like.
It is being billed as the world's first interactive mixed reality game show. And the producers, who are they call themselves a content-driven tech company, and they're producing it with Fremantle, and they reckon it's going to be the fourth age of television, but they really have big hopes for this. And it's the interactive mixed reality bit means that TV viewers at home can also compete via an app on their smartphone or tablet with what's going on the screen.
Yeah, so it's a crazy, I mean, it's an amazing thing, and I don't blame you for closing your eyes to concentrate on actually the concept of the programme here, because it is that kind of thing where it is something that needs a bit of explanation. This is one of the few stories we've ever run in 10 years of Monocle, which has got a glossary. Okay. So you go, you turn up, you know where most TV studios are. They're kind of on the outskirts of cities. They're big warehousey kind of places. But they do have the industry of entertainment about them, the excitement and bustle of making something that will hopefully look better in its end result as it looks at the time. But tell us, when you walk into the studio here, this is a green screen thing. People know what that is. It's what actors have to do in big Hollywood sort of superhero movies and stuff. What's the atmosphere on set like, and what's it look like in the studio itself?
Yeah, it's 500 metres square. It was a big echoey room. We actually visited the room the day before the three contestants were in to film what was the sixth out of eight episodes. But we had a go. We were allowed to go have a go on some of their games, because the contestants have to compete six challenges and then the final in the hour-long episode.
And what sort of things are these, by the way? I mean, there's a picture of a girl shooting something with a cannon. But we should say also there are different zones. We'll talk about it's a bit crystal mazy in that sense,
isn't it? It is very crystal mazy, yeah. Well, the big thing about it is the contestants they get lost in time, and there are six time periods that they travel through. They are Jurassic, Ice Age, Medieval, Wild West, Roaring Twenties, and the future, Space Age, which I may have done in the wrong order. And it was set up for us, the visitors, to have two goes on the games. And I am not their target audience, I should say. I don't play any games on my phone, and I don't really watch game shows. However, I may have been a bit caught up in the buzz, but it did leave me really wanting to watch the final programme, and I might even have to download an app to have a go on the games when and if it comes to the UK or any other country that it gets sold to.
Yeah, I mean, this is an interesting thing, because this is, I mean, you described it, you quoted them saying they believe this will be the fourth age of television, in inverted commas, the size of this building. And there is something strange, because a game show should just be a piece of compelling, you know, sort of human drama on the TV, a bit of Jeopardy, etc. And games are something quite different. So they are melding this world of the kind of Candy Crush, the Pokemon Go, or whatever on the mobile phone, and a compelling game show mechanic. You've seen them putting the whole thing together. We haven't seen a finished programme of it yet. Do you get the feeling they were kind of getting the hang of fixing the game show mechanic with the computer game mechanic and fusing them together successfully?
Yeah, I mean, they're really clear that this has to be a show that works as a game show, as a TV show. They want it, even if you don't want to play along or you've never seen a second screen, they want this to be real family entertainment. It's going to be broadcast at a primetime Saturday night slot. And they think it's going to get the family watching the show together, you know, the teenagers out of their bedrooms, granny can watch it. Because the games test different things like strength, logic, aim, and during the week, you can download these apps and play the games. And say the parents might be able to help with logic games, whereas the kids might be better at those sort of aiming games. So, but they rely on stats like 80% of people watch TV with a second screen. The average gamer is a 43-year-old woman and a 35-year-old man. So, yeah. I think they've got some good stats to back this up. But as long as the actual game show is compelling enough to watch, you know, and it's these three contestants, they compete on a team, but ultimately only one person can take home the prize, which is a million Norwegian kroner, around €135,000. But the real twist here is that so can the viewers, because they can play along all week, and then when the show airs, they can play along as the show's airing. So when the contestants get asked to do a medieval challenge, the medieval challenge will flash up on their app. And I think I had a go at the medieval one.
There's not enough jousting, is there, on the TV?
No, but it was like a flying machine, like a sort of Leonardo da Vinci-esque flying machine. And I sat in a sort of, it felt like a ride at Thorpe Park or Legoland I've done more recently. And so I was sitting in this sort of box that jerked you around, because they're filming everything with all their, you know, motion capture cameras and sensors, so that they want everything to look very physical and work, so that then they can put this physical body into their virtual worlds, which they've photographed and made Hollywood movie quality. They've visited visited real places around the world, taken photos, make them into these things. But anyway, I was flying along and had to sort of dodge obstacles, and it looked like Ha Long Bay, actually, the scenery. I'm not sure what it was supposed to look like, but and you had to sort of travel, take your route. And another one I had to go with, which was actually I did better on, which was the Wild West, and you had to just shoot. Trains were coming along the tracks, and you had to sort of blow up, you know, dynamite or whatever. But that was quite fun. I got 11 out of 16, which was apparently quite a good score. But
that's pretty good stuff.
Not good enough. You had to get 12 to, on the programme itself, you have to get 12 to actually earn the money.
And what were the contestants like? You talk about one of the contestants, a girl who's a teacher who's got, you describe her as having Katniss Everdeen Platt's sort of Hunger Games style. You kind of think, well, she's kind of born to do this, right? How did the people that you saw do the game get on?
Well, there was a company chief executive, there was a sort of strongman bouncer who looked like he did a lot of triathlons and Nordic skiing, and there was this sort of, she was the youngest, I think she was a special needs teacher, and they all had their reasons for being there, which is basically to win the cash. But the event I saw her doing, which was, she was set in the future and sort of firing rockets at invaders to planet Earth or something, she had to pretend to them that she was brilliant at shooting so that they would choose her to do this challenge. But once you're in there doing the challenge, it's sort of, you know, traditional game show stuff, and it's each for your own, and it's a question of whether you want to bank loads of cash or save some seconds to take with you into the final where you actually win the money. So there are some, you know, just your classic game show dynamics going on there. The guys at Fremantle just said it was a bit like Survivor or Jeopardy or Deal or No Deal. You know, they just throw it all in and see what comes out. But they were really pleased with each show, which I haven't seen the final cut, but each show sort of had its own dramatics and storylines, and the contestants would lie to each other, and, you know, there was, you know, as you'd expect. So I think it should be compelling to watch.
So there's a lot going on. Do you think there's too much going on to make it a simple thing? I mean, I guess you play on your smartphone or your computer or whatever at home during the week as a viewer. And then you can kind of pit your wits and aim and judgment on a Saturday night at 8 o'clock in Oslo. Does it feel like that's sort of added on, I wonder? Or does it feel like two worlds colliding beautifully?
I mean, yeah, I don't want to sound like I've swallowed their script, because I'm quite sceptical.
No, say the piece as well. You're kind of like, hang on, I kind of don't get this, and now I get this. And I think it's
I think it's something that will generate a lot of interest when it launches, because I should say that Fremantle want to sell this to different TV producers, channels, whatever,
around
the world,
yeah.
Which they're going to start marketing it in April. They hope they would have another couple of territories signed up by the end of the year. They've had a lot of interest from places as far afield as Mexico and Indonesia. But I think it feels like something that you could sit and watch. And, you know, I mean, two people on the tube this morning were playing Candy Crush, and that was out of six people. So, you know, these things
are
really popular. So
they are.
I think they could be onto something.
We're in the minority. If we're not on our phones playing a game, we're in the minority, aren't we?
Yeah, right? That's true.
Exactly. So you flew this kind of Leonardo da Vinci style flying machine set in the past, in the Middle Ages, whatever it was. Did that, how does that feel? Is that, because this is the fun stuff. This is the stuff other people pay to go to do. You get paid to go and do it occasionally anyway. What's that like? Did that feel realistic? Is that very much like a ride?
It did. I mean, I felt queasy when I came off. I think it only lasted 90 seconds, but it felt like it went on forever. I was strapped in. We were warned not to do it if we were, you know, pregnant or no good with jerky motions. But I thought I'd better try anyway. And it was really realistic. It seemed to go on forever. And I remember I was trying to steer around mountains, and I literally thought I'd crashed into a mountain and that my wings would have fallen off. I mean, it really, you know, it really was realistic, as was this when I was doing the Wild West shoot. shooting. I was the, like, you can see from the picture in the magazine, but there's like a sort of cannon and you're peering into a screen and your head is just, there's no goggles involved, but you're just staring at the screen and you're swinging it from side to side because they need this motion to make it look realistic. And, you know, my heart was pounding, my left hand hurt from when I was gripping the side of it so tightly. And, you know, on the show, the contestants, the other two contestants can call out, like, you know, aim higher, aim left, aim right. But I didn't have anyone doing that. So you're sort of swinging it around, trying to get it. And I really felt like I'd had a workout at the end of it. I mean, I can't imagine it'd be quite so fun to play it on the app, but that's all I can say.
And just finally then, as we say, a lot of programmes have done this time travelling thing. We kind of are in a world where Westworld's been remade as a TV show. All these things, people love this time travel idea. What's the most underwhelming period of time to go back to? Where do you think you should set a game show in New Zealand in the 1950s? Future. Let's do that.
I guess if you lived there, you'd want to do it. I mean, the thing about this is the technology underpinning it is something called Frontier, which is what the Future Group has come up with. They've spent 2.5 years working on it, spent $42 million, which they've got from the, you know, the Norwegian state government funds. But they sell it to the Chinese, they can create their own world. So what might not look that great if you don't live in that country, you can really make it to fit what you want. Yeah, maybe the Jurassic period wasn't so exciting, but horses for courses.
Nice. Susie, thank you so much for talking us through Remote Control, your wonderful story on the set of Lost in Time. It's in this March issue of Monocle. Susie, thank you very much for coming in.
Thank you.
Earlier this year, I had the pleasure of nipping to New York to meet the prolific novelist Paul Auster as he released his almighty new book, 4321. It was an honour. Auster's one of my favourite writers, and I got to sift through the notebooks in which he writes his novels longhand and have a bit of a nose around. Auster's home in Brooklyn is just as I'd imagined. It looks like the stylish, bookish engine room of an urbane imagination. Well, not too long ago, we had Auster's editor, Walter Donahue, in the studio, and he told us whether receiving the initial manuscript from a writer like him still makes the hairs stand up on the back of his neck.
In this case, it did, because it's a novel about the baby boomer generation. And Paul will be 70 in February. And this is that he's looking back on the first 20 years of his life from being born at the end of the 40s. In fact, the cover has a photo of a VE day. Mm. And it ends when he's a student at Columbia in 1969 during the anti-Vietnam riots. So though it's not a memoir, but he uses his life experience to tell the story of that period. And everyone is so now aware of the baby boomer generation because of our legacy, which is these 20-year-olds with terrible debts from going to university, no jobs, rents they can't pay. That's the legacy we left them. We should have left them with prosperity, and we haven't, you know. And so Paul's going back to look at what formed us, you know, and the ideals we had and how it's turned out into what the world we live in today.
It's a novel of great style. It really picks you up and propels you like nothing else I've read by him, actually. And it needs to, because it's a big, long book. What was the back and forth between yourself and Paul on this particular book?
Well, he told me 3 years ago that that's what he was writing. So from the very beginning, he said, this is what it is. And he sent me 100 pages just to get a sense of...
And are they always the first 100 pages, or is that sort of...
No, they were the first 100 pages, just so that there is this device in it where the story is told four different ways. There's a poem by Robert Frost called The Road Not Taken, where a man comes to the crossroads and he can go one way or another, and whatever way he goes, another life is not engaged with. Whereas this time, Paul takes this man and takes him on four paths. And so I read it, and I guess it's a kind of like... You just want to get a sense. I guess he did it with his American editor. Well, will it work? The second time you tell the story, it's sort of the same, but get it slightly different. And then the third, you know, and as a novel goes on, you kind of expect that, expect the changes, what's different. You know, at one point when the boy is 12, he gets hit by lightning in a storm, so he doesn't. So it's only three after that, although every time it comes to him, it's a blank page. So that you get a sense of the richness that is possible, not just in our lives, but the kind of lives, the decisions they make.
That was editor at Faber & Faber, Walter Donahue, there on the new novel by Paul Auster called 4321, which is out now. You can read my interview with the man himself in the culture pages of issue 101 of Monocle. Time for a musical interlude now. Our lead story in this month's issue takes us to Prague. For when Adele wants strings on one of her globe-straddling recordings, this is where she'll go. The same goes for film soundtrack maestros from Ennio Morricone to James Newton Howard. And those tributes to George Michael you saw of him performing with a full orchestra, well, that was Prague again, the Czech National Symphony Orchestra, to be precise. So what's the attraction of the Czech capital and its musicians? Price is certainly a factor, but it's the quality and quantity of Prague's musicians that really stands out in their ability to meet the needs of clients from multiple fields. Our correspondent Guy Delaunay went to Prague to meet them.
If you cut Prague, I reckon there'd be a fair chance that it would actually bleed music. That goes for everything from the street performers chancing their luck on the pavements through to the most famous venue that the city has, the Municipal House, and inside the most ornate venue of them all, the Smetana Hall. And if you come here, you can find all sorts of performances. Every day they're different. Could be classical repertoire like Beethoven and Mozart advertised on one of the billboards, through to film music from Harry Potter, complete with a screening of one of the movies.
We say every Czech is musicians. It's not only work, but it's music, and it's why they like us as an orchestra for recording.
Helena Jirakovska is a violinist with the Czech National Symphony Orchestra. She also leads the internationally renowned Scamper Quartet, and she says communist-era music education helped to foster generations of versatile Czech musicians.
I thought I was forced, just I had a lot of time to study violin. It just was in conservatorium studying in Academy of Music in Prague, in Hochschulerkünste in Berlin. And then I played 20 years in Talich Chamber Orchestra as a leader. I can meet very nice people here in orchestra and also as a guest, just music or perfect opera singers, Edita Gruber and so on. And it's perfect because as a chamber music player, I can't to meet these people.
The string players are taking their seats for a recording at the Czech National Symphony Orchestra studios on the outskirts of Prague.
And what we love to do, it's not a classic, not only classic music, we love to make it fun.
Dusan Mihaly doubles as clarinetist and orchestra coordinator for the CNSO.
So we work with groups like ELO, Electric Light Orchestra, a couple of times, you know, and of course we did big tour with George Michael. We did 50 concerts with George Michael, his big last tour. We did over 100 concerts with Andrea Bocelli over the world. We are absolutely able to do any kind of recording or live performing concert. So that means any request from clients come. Means we do separately string session, brass session, they percussion sections. They ask for jazz group, you know. Yes, that's absolutely not a problem. So we just go through, sit down and play, put scores on the stand, and we just go through.
On this occasion, it's Modern Classical, a work by the contemporary French composer Laurent Chez. And on the other side of the glass, in the studio control room, is an Italian who's become a familiar figure at the CNSO studios. Fabio Venturi is a sound engineer, well known for his work with film score legend Ennio Morricone. He recorded the Oscar-winning soundtrack to Quentin Tarantino's The Hateful Eight in this very studio, and he says that clients like Morricone aren't swayed by Prague's attractive prices, but the quality and flexibility of the orchestras.
Simplicity to work, I mean, the easy way to work here, and that is very important for a musician. For a composer who is really stressed about his score, about his relationship with the director, the movie, etc., to be relaxed in that part of the...
That's one thing they don't need to worry about.
Yes, when we are here and work for they are very in good relationship, good but also very creative, everything ask and discussing artistically, so they have to be relaxed.
Take a tram ride from the CNSO's headquarters in Hostivar to Prague city centre and you'll find another busy recording orchestra. The City of Prague Philharmonic has credits ranging from Take That to the children's TV show Thunderbirds Are Go. There's only one problem for their British producer-cum-booking agent James Fitzpatrick, finding a clear date in the diary.
We are so ridiculously busy, I'm trying to find places for people. I mean, February and March and most of April, there's about 2 days free in all that period at the moment. Producers now are getting a bit fed up with the same old sampled orchestra sound. They want something that's unique to their program. And so people are now coming back to wanting real live orchestras. People are investing more money in the music budgets, and because they want a real orchestra, they want real emotion.
All of this is music to the ears of the orchestras of Prague. There are half a dozen full orchestras and even more smaller ensembles, but there's plenty of work to go around as international artists continue to look east to meet their orchestral needs. For Monocle, in Prague, I'm Guy Delaunay.
Thanks, Guy, and do check out his story in the magazine too. Now, true crime has been creating a buzz for a while now, whether you like your doses in novel, film or podcast form. And now you can add magazine to that list with the Hamburg-based publication Stern Crime. This year, the mag also started doing live readings of some of its twisted and gruesome tales. And Monocle writer Marie-Sophie Schwarzer went along to the premiere performance and she joins us now. Marie, thank you so much for joining us. So tell us about it. It was a couple of weeks ago. It was a dark and stormy night in Hamburg. You were in a theatre and you were watching a performance of something that was far from a play. It was all true and it was all too true crime. So tell us about that night and about where that came from and about where you were sitting and was it scary?
Absolutely.
Four questions for the price of one. That's what I like to provide. I like to provide that service on the show.
So it all took place at the St. Pauli Theatre in Hamburg, which is on the Reeperbahn, the Mile of Sin. It's like the mini Las Vegas of Hamburg.
So do you think that they chose that theatre because, is that kind of a bit of an ironic choice or is that a grand old theatre?
It's actually the oldest private-owned theatre in Hamburg. And it's conveniently located right next to the police station. So
Just in case
anything happens. And it was really great, actually. I didn't know what to expect because it's very rare to see a story within a magazine told up on the stage.
Yeah.
And a very famous actor, Christian Riedel, a German actor, was on stage performing these stories. The first he chose was called Die Witwe, The Widow, and it was about a lady called Istibulat C, who ended up murdering her boyfriends or husbands one by one. And actually, when I read the story, I had nightmares.
Oh, did you really?
Yes.
Okay, so this works on a number of levels. We should tell listeners this is a publishing venture that was so successful in print that they hired Stern, the big German magazine, of which this is an offshoot, this true crime edition, was so successful that they hired a big-name German actor, they hired a theatre, and they thought, well, let's just go for it and do some spooky readings. So how does it actually work? Does it feel like a one-man show when you go and see this play, and I'm putting that in inverted commas, or does it feel like a man reading from a magazine, albeit the story is really well read or really well written?
It reminded me a little of being back home and having someone read a good night story to me, even though it was a nightmare-inducing one.
Okay.
But they had pictures on the walls projected, and there was music to break it up a bit. But really, all eyes were on Christian Riedel as he was performing these stories. And you could tell the audience was deadly silent. Everyone was just entranced by his storytelling.
And where does this, I mean, this is a big question, and we could ask this of an English, an American, an Australian, a Japanese audience. We're asking it of a German audience, I suppose, tonight. People's fascination with this true crime. Because, you know, this kind of, you know, those magazines you get at the supermarket, those kind of, they're what you would have called in the olden days the Woman's Weekly, I guess. And they're very practical, but then they have a real, they have a pretty gory slice of true crime. And it's quite often a bit like SWC. It's often a sort of strange tale of female empowerment where a woman has killed her, you know, nagging husband or violent husband or whatever it might be. Where does that come from? What were the audience like that night in Hamburg? And I wonder if you felt and if you sensed that people were kind of ironically enjoying it, or whether they were really hanging on every word like an old sort of Edgar Allan Poe ghost story.
I was actually expecting more women. It was a lot of couples and even families because around 80% of the readers are women of this true crime stories. So it's their way of escaping a reality, or I don't know. It seems very interesting.
And what was your what was your personal response to it?
I thought it was...
Apart from the fact you had nightmares.
No, I thought it was really well presented, and it was really great to be able to interact with an audience that way, because usually when you're working for a magazine, you don't get to do that, and you don't get to see the response of your audience. And I think they are planning on doing more of these events and perhaps going on a tour around Germany. And I know that they have had TV producers and film producers come knocking because they're so interested in this concept, because there's so much potential in telling these stories. And it's a hype at the moment. Everyone's interested in true crime stories, whether it's on Netflix, Making a Murderer, or podcasts.
Yeah, this is serial. We're right in serial territory here. You went to the office, you went to Stern, and you met the people that put together the magazine as well, right? And what was that like? I mean, are they in a crypt-like office in the basement of Stern magazine, or does it look a little bit like Monocle or any other magazine?
So the Grüner & Jahr offices in Hamburg are beautiful. They have an amazing view of the new Elbphilharmonie, the concert hall, across the river. And the team that works on Stern is the same that works on Stern Crime. So they're always very, very busy.
It's their overtime project.
Yes. Okay. And I was talking to Giuseppe De Grazia, who is the deputy editor of Stern and the editor-in-chief of Stern Crime. And he was telling me a little bit about how it came to be. It was launched in 2015. And it was really interesting to talk to the creative director as well, because he is... Felix Brinkmann, that's his name. He's really inspiring personality, and he does the layout for the magazine, which has won them lots of awards, actually.
And talk us through that, because that is something that sadly we didn't have a chance to put into the magazine. This is something it would be nice if you could bring it to life a little bit, because this isn't a trashy thing. There is something very beautiful in this enterprise, as amusing. And I don't know why we find murder and horror so amusing, but there is a sort of slightly camp side to it all.
People were actually laughing during one of the stories, and Felix Brinkmann was telling me how shocked he was to hear them laughing, because the story is no laughing matter at all, but just the way it was performed and how you can't imagine these things actually happening. I guess that's why.
But it's all true, Marina.
But it is all true.
Well, long may it continue. I mean, this magazine in particular, I suppose, is kind of at the vanguard of this new thing. She went to Hamburg, and thank God she came back alive. Marie-Sophie Schwarzer, thank you very much indeed.
Thank you so much for having me.
And that brings us to the end of today's show. The freshly revamped 101st edition of Monocle is out now. Do go out and pick up a copy. You've been listening to Culture, where my producers were Holly Fisher, who never needs a refresh, and Bill Luty, who possibly does. Who knows? Join me again at the same time next week. For the time being, I've been Robert Bounds. Thank you very much for tuning in.